Hello, everyone. Today, a walk through moonlight and rain. This is Breakfast with Gilgamesh. As the 19th century came to a close, Japan found itself at a cultural crossroad. In 1853, American Commodore Matthew Perry forced open the isolationist nation's ports at gunpoint. This brazen act of colonial rapaciousness forced Japan to face a decision: fight and die to preserve its robust and unique cultural traditions, or adapt and modernize. The history of Western colonialism is a history of destroyed cultures and scattered peoples, and so within the span of a single lifetime, Japan morphed into not just an industrial nation, but itself a massive colonial empire on the world stage. In many ways, this period is the most important 5 or 6 decades in the nation's history. Every major event that Japan caused or faced in the 20th century feels like a consequence of how quickly, effectively, and vigorously it became a modern nation. Today, Japan's culture is a global obsession. People from all over the world watch Japanese films and television shows, read Japanese comic books, eat Japanese food, and play Japanese video games. Ask anyone on Earth what a samurai or a geisha is, and they'll likely be able to tell you. Japan has gone from a country whose culture gestated and formed for centuries in complete isolation to one who influenced and is influenced by the world in a way wholly unique to the modern world. Only American and Indian culture can rival Japan's grip on the global zeitgeist. As many people seem to know the name Godzilla as the name Jesus. It might also seem at first glance that a reason for Japan's proliferation of its culture is how intentional and diligent Japan is about maintaining its cultural identity and history. However, this was not always so. Particularly in the wake of Perry's assault on Edo Bay, Japan was at odds with its cultural history during the modernization period. Highly respected figures suggested that Japan ought to move on from its so-called cultural backwardness. Ghost stories, folk tales, and other superstitions pervaded the country, particularly among the farmer and workman classes. As the caste system was abolished and the samurai were dissolved, men like Inoue Enryo believed that the myths of the past are best left in the past, as Japan became a modern nation. He developed yokaiology, the study of yokai, which is a blanket term for various ghosts, fairies, spirits, and goblins, which classified each as a psychological or cultural phenomenon in order to debunk it. However, at this critical juncture, two figures emerged to defend and preserve these stories. Lafcadio Hearn was a journalist born in an American colony in Greece. He found himself in Japan on a doomed assignment for a journal, and chose to stay after his contract fell through. He put down roots in Japan, taking a Japanese name, a Japanese wife, and a job as a schoolteacher. He was in love with the country, its rich symphony of customs and cultural idiosyncrasies. He collected ghost tales, folk wisdom, and regional culture, and wrote it all down, publishing a number of books to a Victorian audience ravenous for a taste of Japan's customs, at this time a great mystery to the West. Kunio Yanagita's story is rather similar. Yanagita was an administrator for the Department of Agriculture, but his passion for mythology and folktale led him to quit his comfortable office job and travel through rural Japan, in particular, the northern Tono region, a place of deep-rooted cultural custom and folklore. Yanagita, with the help of a young writer fresh out of university named Kizan Sasaki, wrote down many of these stories and systematized their preservation. Yanagita and Sasaki's work was published in Japanese, but largely sold outside of Japan. Yanagita himself declared that his work was for Japanese living abroad. Though the history of Japan's folklore is an expansive tapestry of cultural, political, and religious history, these two figures are critically important to the preservation of Japanese folklore as we know it today. Many folklorists work tirelessly and with great passion to preserve Japan's storytelling culture through universal mediums such as literature, cinema, and music, as well as mediums unique to Japan such as Rakugo, No, and Kamishibai. The three stories I have to share today, just as every story does, travels along a circuitous and perilous path to reach your ears, but it's very possible they would be lost to time if not for the work of Yanagita and Hearn. The following stories are Japanese, but are my responsibility in the tradition of the oral storyteller, so I hope you'll forgive any embellishments, deviations, or outright flights of fancy that I indulge in as I tell them to you. So now, let's begin with three tales of moonlight and rain. Long time ago, on the edge of a small farming village, facing a great and endless wood, there lived a newly wed couple from Edo. The husband, who had been an administrator to a local lord, purchased his plot to start a new life and, with his bride in tow, enjoy the fresh air and peace of the countryside. His wife, a lifelong city girl, missed her family and the amenities of a city, restaurants, theaters, friends. She came along with her new husband, but as the days passed in work and cultivation, her loneliness was compounded by her husband always being gone in the fields. One fine morning, as she was cleaning up from breakfast, a little sparrow, no bigger than a mouse, landed on her windowsill and trilled to the lifting sun as its light passed through the trees. The girl's ever-lingering sorrow seemed to lift with this tiny bird's presence, as if an old friend had come to visit and fill her with cheer. She scooped a waxy dollop of starch from the bottom of the rice bowl she was cleaning and outstretched it to her new friend, who lapped it up and went on singing, filling the kitchen with happiness. For many months, the sparrow, whom our bride named Suzumi-san, came to the window each morning to trill and chirp and sing to the rising sun. The happiness this brought the young woman was boundless. She taught Suzumi little tricks, like bowing in respect and trilling when the bride said her name. The bride forgot her troubles and her loneliness, her longing for restaurants and theaters and friends. The husband, however, was not so content. His crops had failed, his work was hard, and to go back to the city now would be humiliating. He was running out of money and spending what little he had on cheap drink, which he guzzled like a black secret in his shed each night, before passing out on the floor and muttering about his problems. He watched his bride play with that creature, and it annoyed him deeply. He believed that he was above being jealous of a little tree sparrow, and yet... One night, the husband, in a drunken stupor, stumbled into the kitchen and fell asleep in the fire pit. His wife awoke alone, and when she found her groom snoring in the soot, she sighed and snuck out the door quietly to collect his empty liquor bottles from the path leading up to the house, a vain attempt to keep up appearances. While she was gone, Suzumi-san flitted into the windowsill, and as the sun's light crept over the precipice and into the kitchen, she began to chirp and trill. The husband jerked awake to the sound. It rattled in his head like a marble and caused him agony. He stumbled out of the soot pit and grumbled a long string of curses at the little bird, who bowed low, just as the wife had taught her. The husband, unmoved by the show of contrition, grabbed the little sparrow in his gnarled, work-worn hands. It squeaked in pain and fear, so shocked it was that its tongue jutted out of its mouth.
"I'll shut you up," grunted the husband.
He pulled the kama, a garden sickle, from his belt, and held the little sparrow down on the ground, squeezing it so its mouth hung agape. With the tip of his kama, he cut Suzumi's little tongue out and threw the poor creature at the window like a plum pit. The bride returned to find her husband hunched over the ground, holding the kama in his hand, its tip bloodied just so. "Are you all right, husband?" asked the bride.
"Huh?"
The husband looked up, and a pang of guilt sprang up in his stomach and into his throat.
"Everything is fine, dear. Everything's fine. Please, make some breakfast. I didn't sleep well."
For many days, the bride waited by the window for Suzumi-san to return. She worried terribly that Suzumi-san had been caught by a cat or injured by a falling branch. It's a hard world out there for little things, after all. Evenings passed in silence, the bride's tears drying on her cheeks as she prepared her husband's meals, wondering all the time what could have happened to her only friend. The rice she prepared for her husband was bitter, soiled by sorrow. Eventually, the husband, sobered by his bride's loneliness, confessed his crime. He explained that Suzumi's chattering drove him mad. He explained what he had done to her, and that he was sorry.
"How could you?" she asked him. "How could you?" she repeated as she stood and made for the door, not bothering to wrap herself in an overcoat or put on her shoes. "How could you?" she repeated as her form disappeared from the doorframe into the night, into the woods to search for her lost friend.
The trees of the forest cast jagged and whispering shadows on the bride's worried face as she trod deeper into the night. There was a gentle wind which seemed to encourage her, brushing up on her cheeks from behind her, urging her ahead. She called desperately for Suzumi-san, pleading forgiveness for her husband's violence and promising to nurse her back to health. As the moon peered from behind unseen clouds and illuminated the forest floor, she could see just ahead a swale, deep and rocky, where a stream rested at the bottom, glistening in the moonlight, its many smooth rocks. Little fish passing through, their bodies glimmering. She curled her brow as the moon was once more enveloped by the clouds. But there, in the water, a light reflecting just so. She looked up, and at the top of the hill, opposite where she stood, a window glowing pleasantly and invitingly among the trees. She carefully stepped over the little brook, and just then could hear the trilling of a sparrow coming from the house. She hastened up the hill, tears once more staining her face. But these were tears of joy. Perhaps Suzumi had simply found a new home. Perhaps these people living in their strange house in the woods had been taking care of her. She wanted to thank them, and most of all, she wanted to ask Suzumi-san's forgiveness. Even if the sparrow never returned to sing at her window, she could live with her loneliness, but only with Suzumi-san's forgiveness. At the top of the hill, she straightened her back and was horrified to find only more trees. She wondered if her guilt had driven her mad, but then she heard the trilling again, that beautiful sparrow song which brought her joy each day. She darted her head from side to side, looking for any sign of the little sparrow. When there came a gentle and eerie mist, it slithered through the trees and poured over the hill behind her. Among the mist there arrived Onibi, ghost lights. They twirled and hopped between the trees playfully, terrifying the bride, who knelt down and begged forgiveness from the forest spirits for disturbing their home with her calling.
"You have nothing to apologize for, sweet woman."
The voice was soft and regal, like a lady of court. The bride lifted her head and saw there before her on the ground, Suzumi-san. The little bride collapsed to her knees and bowed to the little bird.
"Suzumi-san, I've come looking for you to beg forgiveness. You are the only friend I have, and my husband drove you away. I wish only to care for you and beg for your grace."
The sweet laughter of the voice reminded the bride of the sparrow's trill.
"My wounds have healed, child. My heart is so glad to see you. You were a wonderful host and a most loyal friend. It is I who should beg your grace, but I hope a little hospitality will do."
In wonder, the bride lifted her head. Where the sparrow stood was now a woman with a face as bright and beautiful as the moon itself. Her smile was enchanting and mysterious, but the kindness in her eyes was as clear as the water of the stream.
"Come with me," said Suzumi-san. "Come to my home and let me show you my gratitude."
As if it had always been there, the house the bride had seen from the bottom of the hill seemed to materialize from the mist. From within, the bride could hear warm and inviting music and cheer, as if a party was in full swing. She missed parties terribly. She followed the woman who was a sparrow through the great doors of the house. Her cheeks red with laughter, her belly full with feasting, and her heart warm with happiness, the bride touched Suzumi on the hand and set her head on her silken shoulder.
You have been so kind to me, Suzumi-san. I haven't been this happy since I came to the little village where my new home lies. I resented for so long that fate should snatch me from the place I grew up to that little home by the woods. And now, I'm grateful because it brought me to you. With glassy eyes, Suzumi-san placed her cheek on the bride's forehead and whispered, "You are a kind and noble soul. You will always be my friend, and you will always be welcome to this place to find cheer when you need it." Tearfully, the two women embraced, and as the bride stood to make for the exit, there in the doorway were two gifts. One, a large wicker basket with thick shoulder straps and something hefty within, which made its bottom end bulge and distend. Beside it, a simple cloth bag, no bigger than the bride's hand, tied shut with grass rope. "Please," said Suzumi-san, "take your gift of choice, a token of my eternal friendship to you." Not wanting to be ungracious and remembering the steep hill she'd have to navigate to go back home, she picked up the little cloth bag and tucked it into her shirt, then made her way. The sun was rising as the bride emerged from the woods. Her clothes were dirty, her feet were caked in mud, but on her face was pure, serene bliss. She didn't even mind the drunken state she found her husband in as she came in, once again laid out by the fire pit, covered in soot and reeking of sake. She hurriedly made breakfast, as her husband grogged and moaned awake, rubbing his aching neck and muttering complaints about how worried he was for her. The bride dolloped rice into a bowl as she explained what had happened. The rice, to the husband's astonishment, was sweet and clean-tasting. Then the bride got to the part about the gifts, the big basket and the little bag. He watched her pull the little purse from her shirt and carefully untie it. When it unfurled, both of them were astonished. Golden tails and shimmering gems sprinkled their sooty floor, sparkling so brightly as to illuminate the entire house.
"Why, this is magnificent," said the bride. "Our troubles are over. This is enough to live off for the rest of our lives. No more toil, no more dirt. Oh, thank you, little sparrow, thank you."
The husband, however, did not share in his bride's joy. He growled and stood up straight.
"You're a fool. If you had taken the basket, I'd be a lord. We could own this village and a dozen more like it. Go back, right now, and ask for the basket."
"I couldn't," said the bride. "Suzumi-san was so kind. How could I return and insist on further kindness? What kind of friend would I be?"
"Ah," grunted the husband. "I'll do it myself."
And he made for the woods. The husband spent the entire day in the thick and tangled wood. The sun found the horizon, and as darkness set in, so did a cold and angry rain. The husband called out through the wind for the sparrow.
"Little bird, reveal yourself, little spirit, little ghost, I come in peace, to apologize for my great misdeed."
After much pleading, he could just make out the sound of a sparrow's trill through the storm. He followed it until the sun was completely gone, and there he saw the swale, and in it the brook, and behind it the hill, and atop it the house. He stamped through the little stream and began scrambling up the hill on his hands and knees, calling out,
"Little bird, reveal yourself, little spirit, little ghost, I come in peace, to apologize for my great misdeed."
Eventually he reached the top of the hill, but, to his frustration, there was nothing there. The house he had seen was gone. He snarled and beat his fist on the ground and began stomping forward through the trees.
"Where is the mist? Where are the Onibi? Where is the great hall of the sparrow spirit? Please, little bird, my wife is sweet, but she is not smart. She should have taken the basket you offered her. I've come to collect it. I promise not to harm you. I just want the basket."
He wandered ahead, soaked and desperate,
then tripped over something and fell flat on his face in the mud. He sprang up and screamed against the rain, whirling around to see what had the audacity to get in his way. He froze. There in the mud, knocked over by his clumsiness, was the woven basket. He fell to his knees and cackled as he heaved the basket upright and slid his arms between the thick straps. He could barely lift it, but he was determined. His feet struggled to find purchase as he groaned and flipped the basket onto his back, then began for the lip of the hill. He made it, and only just, to that precipice, and his own legs gave out, almost sending him over the edge. He saved himself and let the basket down, cursing to himself and wondering how he would get the damn thing home. He could roll the basket down the hill, but all that gold might burst from the wicker, and as it breaks, go rushing down the stream at the bottom and never be seen again. He thought hard as the rain beat down on his head, and decided that the best course of action would be to open the basket, take as much gold as he could carry in his shirt, and make trips up and down the hill until the basket was empty, then carry the empty basket down and be on his way to wealth and power. He unwove the wicker at the top of the basket, carefully, his fingers cutting against the wet edges. Finally, when the wicker came loose, he pried open the top and peered inside at his reward. Instantly, he flew backwards, screaming and flailing his arms. He slipped and rolled down the hill, breaking each limb against root and slippery rock until his ruin collided with the slowly filling stream. His head leaked blood and made the brook a cherry red in the moonlight, little fish gathering among his hair drifting in the current. At the top of the hill stood the wicker basket, open now and filling with rainwater, and inside it, the husband's corpse, his head tilted to face the moon, his mouth agape, and without a tongue. It is said that in the city of Kyoto, long ago, the good people lived in fear, not of any warlord or plague, but of a killer, hidden in shadow, who came out at night and stalked the road near Rashomon Gate. This killer was said to be no man, but an oni, a demon who ate the flesh of children and drank the blood of women, whose soul had no pity and whose appetite had no end. This tale traveled far and wide, spoken of so often that it became, for the people of Kyoto at least, a simple truth. Never venture near Rashomon Gate after dark. You will never be seen or heard from again. Not even a corpse will be left to cremate you with. So it went that this tale traveled through the streets and alleys, from lip to ear to lip to ear, until even the gentry, in their great manors and courts, knew the story of the ogre of Rashomon Gate. One such man was Watanabe, a vassal of Lord Raiko. Raiko was famous for slaying the demon king Oyama and scattering his army to the wind in a single swift swing of his blade. Though Watanabe often dreamed of such glory, he held to a reserved, practical nature which, in his heart of hearts, precluded the very existence of such things. He, like any rational man, assumed that the story of Raiko's defeat of the demon king was simply an exaggeration, a result of the peasant's penchant for hyperbole and fantasy. As is often the case with great deeds, once news of Lord Raiko's triumph over some bandit king or gang leader reached the mouths of the lower classes, he may as well have felled a dragon with a single blow.
"Have you heard," asked Hojo, another samurai under Lord Raiko, "about the ogre of Rashomon Gate?"
"Ah, yes, of course."
They sat in the main hall of a stately brothel, sipping tea and waiting for their rooms to be ready.
"They say," said Hojo, "that not even a trace of the victims can be found. They say the ogre eats his victims whole."
I'm sure they do.
You doubt the story, brave Watanabe?
I can only say that our Lord Raiko vanquished the demon King Oyama and banished the Oni from our land. Even if there were such thing as a demon, it wouldn't dare show his face in Kyoto with our Lord living here.
So you don't believe it? You think I'm a fool for believing such things?
Do you believe such things?
Of course. What need have the good people of this city to lie? And what character could a demon have but one that is defiant, obstinate, and cruel?
What character could a peasant have but one that is panicked, gossipy, and foolish?
So you do disbelieve what I tell you. You think I'm telling you a falsehood.
Watanabe straightened his back, then bent his chin into his chest. Forgive me, Honorable Hojo. I don't think you're lying to me. But you have heard some peasant tale and let it spook you. That's all. Hojo laughed and stroked the top of his head with the palm of his hand.
Immovable as ever, Watanabe. But I wonder.
Watanabe lifted his head, and a curious wrinkle of his brow overtook his usually stoic face.
Would you like to prove what you say? It's quite late. The sun won't be up for many hours. I wonder if you would go to Rashomon Gate right now and see what waits for you there.
Without a moment's hesitation, Watanabe rose to his feet. Of course I'll go. I'll leave at once. But first...
First?
First, we must establish terms.
Proceed.
I will go to Rashomon Gate. I will wait for a while for something to appear, and when nothing does, I will return. Once done, you'll pay my bill for the evening. Hojo laughed from his belly and stood to meet Watanabe's stern glare.
Good. Fine. But of course, I'll need some proof.
What proof do you require?
One moment.
Hojo walked off, and as Watanabe waved off the hostess trying to bring him to the room he had been waiting for, Hojo presented him with a piece of parchment rolled tight with a silk hair ribbon.
That has my signature on it. Place it on Rashomon Gate, and first thing tomorrow we'll return together. If the note is still there, I'll pay for your sex and drink for a month.
Watanabe pursed his lips, pretending a disapproval of Hojo's gauche phrasing. He tucked the note into his nagagi and turned to retrieve his sword and his horse. The rain was cold and penetrating. It made the tips of Watanabe's fingers ache and his teeth chatter. He turned onto the road to Rashomon and urged his horse into a steady gallop, eager to get this over with. The gate was 20 feet tall and made of dark, firm wood. During the day it had a pleasing red hue, but at night it appeared black as pitch. There was, of course, nobody else on the road, and he could just barely make out the gate through the darkness and rain as he approached. Watanabe's horse came to a stop some 20 feet from the gate and refused to go a step further. He dismounted his horse and muttered his aggravation as he tugged on the beast's bridle in vain for a few seconds, then resigned himself to trudging through the mud, soiling his robes and making his feet cold and wet. He unfurled the scroll with Hojo's signature and stuck it to a bent nail which protruded from one of the thick, cracked struts. As he turned back to the road, he noticed that his horse was missing. He froze when he heard a sound like laughter over the pounding wind and thundering rain. A chill went up Watanabe's back, and he wrapped his fingers around the hilt of his sword, thumbing the guard to release it from the scabbard. He took a step forward, and suddenly something very heavy slammed into the mud in front of him, and at that very instant he was grabbed by the collar and yanked backwards. He snatched the handle of his sword and swung his arm over his head, swiping at whatever had him. There was a horrible wailing sound, and he was dropped into the mud. Watanabe groaned and flipped himself onto his hands and knees, heaving as the rain battered him in the darkness. He got to his feet with some effort and held tight to his sword, screaming over the rain.
"Who's there? Show yourself!"
But there was no answer. He stumbled around, unable to see much more than a foot or so in front of him. Eventually, he tripped over something and went face first into the ground. When he got up, he let out a yelp of shock and horror, seeing the severed head of his horse slathered in gore on the road before him. He scrambled back in a panic, feeling through the puddles for his sword, which was flung away when he tripped.
After a few moments, he felt something in the mud, but knew right away it wasn't his sword. It was huge, the size of a tree trunk, and curiously, it was covered in long, wiry hair. Watanabe pulled hard, and the earth released what Watanabe realized was the severed arm of his attacker. It was a hand and forearm, almost the length of one of his legs. It was blue, and the black nails on the tip of each thick finger were curled and jagged. He thought he heard something beneath the rainfall, a woeful moan of pain. He stumbled ahead, severed limb under his arm, and saw the glint of his sword in a puddle. He snatched it up and kissed it, then clasped the arm like a mother holding her baby, and jogged back down the road, away from Rashomon Gate, thinking all the way that whatever attacked him must be watching, and that he mustn't stop running until he's back at the inn with Hojo. It was in the deepest part of the night when Watanabe stumbled through the doors of the inn, which was quiet save for the snoring of a few scattered customers who had passed out, bellies full of wine on the floor. The night mistress hurried towards Watanabe, who was muddy and undressed, his robe wrapped in something under his arm.
"Sir, are you all right? What's happened to you?"
"I," stuttered Watanabe,
"I slew the ogre of Rashomon Gate."
Watanabe's story became the talk of the town, and soon noised all of Tokyo, Kyoto, and even Hokkaido. His name was shouted in the street. Rakugo and Kamishibai gathered crowds to tell the tale of brave Watanabe, who waved his mighty sword and dismembered the man-eating fiend who bedeviled the good people. Watanabe was a legend, almost as revered as Lord Raiko, and was given vassals of his own, and a great manor with many rooms, and the wealth and social position of a hero to the nation. Watanabe, however, was a ball of nerves. He found no peace in his wealth or happiness in his fame. He was quick-tempered with servants and withered from social calls. He sat in his mansion day in and day out as the country celebrated his bravery, deeply, unendingly afraid. Watanabe knew that out there somewhere was the ogre of Rashomon Gate. He knew that what he had told the mistress that fateful night was a lie. True, he had dismembered the demon. True, he had the arm as proof of his battle. But the demon lived. It was out there somewhere, healing, waiting, plotting its revenge. He commissioned a great artisan of wood to carve the holy sutras, every single one, into the finest redwood. He had that redwood fashioned into a box, and into that box he placed the arm, which had not even begun to rot, still fresh as the day it was claimed, a reminder that its owner was not gone from this earth. Each nail which sealed the box was made of holy iron, blessed by monks and sanctified against evil. The box was placed in a small room deep within Watanabe's mansion, and in that room the walls were covered in sutras, and each night a priest lit incense beneath the enormous iron bar which kept the room sealed and said a prayer. All of this done in secret, so as not to let on that the deed for which Watanabe was so celebrated was a half-truth. The lie haunted Watanabe as much as the looming threat it represented. It clouded his mind and isolated him. Watanabe never took a wife, though many offers came. He never saw Hojo or his other friends, for his mere presence was, unbeknownst to them, a danger to their lives. He wept quietly in his private quarters each night, and each day he made the appearances and performed the rituals his lordship required of him, and promptly returned to his room to weep some more until sleep took him. One night there came a knocking at the front gate of the manor. One of Watanabe's attendants approached and saw an old woman in fine robes waiting with a pleasant tranquility about her face. He lowered his guard and bowed slightly.
"Madam, the hour is late. How can I help you?"
"Let me see the great hero, Watanabe. Please let me in."
Good lady, it's quite late. Far too late for company. Come back in the morning."
"Please let me in. It's raining and I'm quite old. I came a long way to see Watanabe."
"Raining?"
The guard held out his hand in front of him to show the old woman that the sky was quite clear. And just then, a drop of cold water fell into his palms and chilled his bones. In an instant it was a downpour, and the attendant scrambled to unlatch the iron gate and let the lady and himself inside. As the woman and the attendant made their way down the main hall, the old woman spoke cheerfully.
"I was Watanabe's nanny, you see. I came all the way from Hokkaido to see him.
The guard asked her to wait, then scurried off to find Watanabe, who was holed up in the room with the iron bar across the door.
My nanny? Watanabe asked. My nanny was an old woman when I was a baby. If she wasn't dead, she'd be far too old to travel so far to get here.
Apologies, my lord. I'll send her away.
No, no, just keep her in the main hall. I'll be there in a minute.
After some time, Watanabe produced himself and saw the old woman sitting peacefully, humming a tune he remembered distinctly from his childhood. The sound of her voice immediately brought him to wistful tears, and he collapsed to his knees at her feet.
Good woman, how is it possible? You haven't aged a day, and here you are, come to see a fool like me of all people.
Of all people, indeed. To think my little Gendo is the hero of Kyoto. What a brave warrior you've become.
I am nothing, dear woman. I am only a foolish, lonely man whose dreams are haunted. Nothing more.
Why, what ails you, my child?
It's quite complicated, dear woman. I am beset by visions of demons.
Demons? Like the one you slew?
Watanabe nodded, taking both of the old woman's hands in his and pressing his forehead into her curled, withered knuckles.
I've heard, said the old woman, that you won a trophy in the battle. I should like to see such a thing indeed.
Ah, yes, the arm. I keep it stowed quite safely in this very mansion to, protect it from burglars and thieves.
That is sensible, wise Watanabe. Very sensible. Do you take me for a burglar or a thief?
No, no, of course not. That's ludicrous.
Then surely you won't refuse an old woman a glance at your prize.
Watanabe hesitated.
It's a horrible sight. You may turn ill just to behold it.
I've seen many things in my long life, Watanabe. Many strange things, but nothing so strange as the arm of an ogre. I have so little time left on this earth. So much I wish I had done. I do not regret dedicating my life to raising children. It is the greatest joy to see a child grow to brave deeds and beautiful manners. But I must admit to you, brave Watanabe, that I wish to live a life of adventure. Can you understand that, Watanabe? To be respected and beloved, but to not know peace?
I can understand that, dear woman.
Then surely you won't refuse me just a glance.
Watanabe took a deep breath, bowed, and told the old woman to wait there in the main hall. After some time, Watanabe emerged with the great box under his arm. He placed it in front of the old woman's feet and lifted the lid. Her old, milky eyes alighted as she beheld the grotesque limb within.
Just marvelous. Would you bring it closer, dear boy? My eyes aren't what they used to be, and my back is far too frail to bend down any closer.
Watanabe did as he was told. He grasped the arm by the stump and the wrist and held it up for his old nanny to see closely.
Ah, what a marvel. What a prize. What a foolish, lonely man.
The old woman swiped at the arm and yanked it from Watanabe with supernatural force.
Finally!
She roared. She outstretched her arms from beneath her thick robes, and one was missing at the bicep, a gnarled stump. She mashed the severed arm into it, and in an instant the still fresh flesh on the end of that horrible arm exploded and clasped its former host with sinew and horrible skin, spreading along her old body and replacing the facade of an old woman with teeth, hair, and muscle. The demon's great round eyes glowed in gleeful wrath as Watanabe fell backwards. He scrambled to his feet and in a single swipe of his sword from its sheath left a deep cut in the demon's chest. It screamed in horrendous agony and leapt into the air, bursting through the ceiling. Watanabe was left there in the hall, staring up at the moon through the rainfall that soaked his dumbstruck face, filling the now empty box. No ogre was ever seen at Rashomon Gate, or indeed all of Kyoto, ever again.
1,000 years ago, in Denonura, in the Shimonoseki Strait, a battle which would decide the fate of Japan took place. 1,000 ships crashed against one another, spilling men and their blood into the sea, washing red foam against the southern tip of Honshu. Taira Antoku, the rightful heir to the throne of Japan, was cast into the ocean by his grandmother before he could be captured. He was 7, drowned a child along with the legions of arrow-pierced sword-slash-men who protected him. The Taira clan, betrayed by the defector Taguchi Shigeyoshi, was brought to its knees by the Minamoto clan and vanquished forever. Thus ended the Genpei War. Thus began the shogunate of Minamoto no Yoritomo and the bloody Kakamura period. As the waves crashed against the shores of Shimonoseki and the blood of the Taira clan made the water bitter, it is said that the domain of the Taira, known as Heiki, was cursed. Onobi, the ghost lights, lingered in the darkest corners of the night. The ancient cemeteries gave their dead no rest. Vicious storms raged in retribution for the memory of the child king, and the spirits of the warriors who lost that great war became crabs, their faces twisted in agony, imprinted on their shells. Wars raged throughout Japan for many years. Centuries passed. The Minamoto clan rose and was overthrown, just as all warlords are, replaced by new warlords who were replaced by new warlords, and so on and so on. And so, we find ourselves in the garden of a small Buddhist temple called Amidaji, in the sleepy town of Shimonoseki. There arrived one rainy afternoon a young monk by the name of Hoichi, his biwa in hand, and not a sliver of gold to his name. He was welcomed warmly by the old priest, who ran the temple, a lover of music and poetry, which he said brought a sweetness to the bitter water of the well, and made the forest seem not so gloomy. Hoichi was a wonderful reciter of poetry, and the sound of his biwa made the air feel cool and content on hot summer nights. Hoichi had no love for paintings or kabuki, for he was blind. His love was in music and the spoken word, and he practiced at these things diligently and endlessly. Each night, Hoichi would sit, biwa in his lap, and sing of the great war so many years ago with poetic eloquence. He would recite and pluck until the last monk of Amidaji had retreated to his bed, then recite a little longer for the moon's entertainment. One quiet autumn night, as twilight approached, Hoichi, alone on the simple veranda which faced the stone path toward the temple, plucked at his biwa carelessly, enjoying a cool breeze which caressed his cheek. It was then, as the air turned frigid, and the moon fell behind dark clouds, Hoichi could hear the muffled clatter of iron and leather as footsteps approached along the stone path. He placed his hand flat against the strings of his biwa to silence it, and wondered for a moment if he was dreaming, until he heard his name whispered on the wind like a secret. Hoichi. He raised his head and set his biwa down. Hoichi. Who's there? Please, I can't see you. I beg you, announce yourself.
Hoichi!
At this, Hoichi leapt back and fell under his own feet, waving his arms and exclaiming, Ah, please, I'm only a blind beggar monk.
There is no need to fear, Hoichi. I mean you no harm. I have come from nearby Akamagaseki, at the behest of my lord, an exceedingly high-ranking official. He has heard of Hoichi the blind monk, and how exquisite his recitation of the Battle of Denonura is. He has commanded his humble servant to collect you and bring you to his great house, that his court might hear the story of the fall of the Taira clan.
Hoichi knew instantly that this stranger was a samurai, and the command of a samurai is not lightly dismissed. So right away he stood, collected his biwa, and outstretched his hands.
I would be honored.
Hoichi could hear the nightbird's call as he stepped carefully forward through thick and gnarled wood. The samurai's hand was firm on his arm, but it never tugged at him, They did not speak a word to each other, only listened to the wind pass through the trees and crackle their leaves in the dry air. At length, the air grew thick and wet, as if a great fog had emerged. And just then, Hoichi was ushered up a great set of stone stairs by his guide, and at length he was brought to the huge wooden doors of a castle, whose low and thunderous creaking as they opened sent a chill down his spine. And at length he was ushered through long, silent hallways to a central chamber and set on a warm, inviting floor. He sat and placed his biwa on his lap, bowing deeply and waiting to be commanded. Hoichi of Amidaji, we request, for our entertainment, the story of Heiki.
Lord, I would be most honored, but as the story of Heiki is too vast a tale for one evening, I humbly ask if there is a specific story of Heiki the Lord would like to hear tonight.
Tell us of Danoura.
Hoichi plucked at his biwa and sang most beautifully. He could make the strings sound like the waves of the bitter ocean, and when his voice quivered, the air seemed to chill. He spoke passionately of the great battle, and the tragedy of the child king was met by the sound of weeping from his attentive audience. When the final chord had settled, Hoichi placed his biwa before him and bowed deeply. There was no applause or recognition. There was no commendation or compliment, only silence. Hoichi raised himself and was struck to feel the dew of morning on his brow and the sound of birdsong. He outstretched his hand to pick up his biwa and could feel a beam of sun warm on the top of his hand. He was back at Amidaji, and it was the dawn. The monks of Amidaji stroked their chins thoughtfully each morning as Hoichi, his pallor sickly, his shoulders slumped, shuffled off to his room each morning as the sun came up. He would sleep until late into the day, eat a modest meal, and as the sun began to set, he would take his place on the veranda, which faced the south, and pluck idly at his biwa, as if waiting for something. This went on for many days, and each day Hoichi looked somehow withered, older, like a reed plucked from its stalk and left in the sun to rot. One day, as Hoichi slumbered through the afternoon, the abbot of Amidaji called on two young attendants. He brought them to the southern veranda and pointed at the spot where Hoichi sat each night.
When he sits there, you watch him. Should he rise from this spot, you will follow him. Stay hidden. Keep your distance. Don't interfere unless Hoichi is in danger. I want to know where he goes each night. Is that understood?
The two youngsters nodded eagerly. Rumors travel quickly through the monastery just as they do anywhere. They were as curious as anyone, and desperate to please their dear abbot. They waited until the sun was slipping into the horizon, and placed themselves just inside the temple with a screen to hide behind. They would watch through the slit they had cut especially for this task, with the permission of the abbot. In shifts they watched, one sleeping and one watching. The gentle plucking of the biwa was pleasant to the ear, and would call them to doze. But they were determined to know what Hoichi did with himself each night. As the samurai approached through the woods, the two attendants dozed peacefully behind their screen, woken only by the warrior's august growling.
Hoichi, I have come again to fetch you for my lord. Will you refuse him?
No, of course not. Please, take me to him.
The attendants scrambled to their feet and shushed each other, watching through the slit as Hoichi wandered into the woods. They crept behind but found it surprisingly hard to keep up with the blind man. He seemed to know precisely where he was going and how to get there. He didn't bump into anything, and he didn't pause even when a horrible frigid rain came crashing through the trees, soaking everything and making the attendants' teeth chatter. For his part, Hoichi had taken his place on the ground before the lords who summoned him each night, and once again they requested to hear the tale of the Battle of Danoura. Hoichi bowed and began to recite. He sang beautifully, despite his exhaustion. The attendants seemed to have lost their mark, wandering between the trees, eventually resorting to calling out Hoichi's name in desperation, screaming so loudly over the rain that one of them had to fall flat on his face, tripping over an errant tree root in order to hear the sound of music just over the crest of a muddy hill.
The two boys, soaked and confused, made their way towards the sound and turned white as a sheet when they found Hoichi sitting on the ground among a court of great tombstones. Onibi, the ghost lights, dancing all around him. The older of the two lads sprung forward. He could not see, for the rain and darkness, until he was standing over Hoichi, that he was covered almost completely in Heiki crabs, the gnarled faces of their shells glistening and furious in the storm. He screamed Hoichi's name, but Hoichi went on singing, as if he was still sitting on the veranda on a warm summer day. It took both of the boys to brush away the crabs and yank Hoichi to his feet. Instantly, as if a spell had been broken, Hoichi began coughing and shivering violently. He was rake-thin and very ill. The smaller of the boys helped him climb onto the taller one, and they carried Hoichi all the way home in the torrent and thunder, lighting a fire in the cooking pit and covering him in thick blankets and fur. Once they were certain Hoichi was not dead, the elder one went to fetch the abbot and tell him of all they saw that night in the woods. The abbot of Amadaji stroked his chin thoughtfully as he heard the recounting of the two boys, supplemented by the shivering, apologetic account of Hoichi himself between gulps of soup and rice, bundled tight in the temple's thickest blankets.
"It doesn't make any sense," said the elder of the young monks. "There are so many storytellers in Shimonoseki, and more still who've come to our temple to practice their art. Why should this phantom samurai appear only to Hoichi?"
"Because," said the abbot, "Hoichi's recounting is the most beautiful, and because Hoichi cannot see the horrible truth of his lord's predicament. To be dead and find no rest, to linger in such a place, cursed and forgotten, it must be maddening. No spirit can withstand being forgotten. But to be the rightful lord of this land, to have been betrayed, to have lost everything, the desire to know that your story is still told, and to hear it told so beautifully, as only Hoichi can. No, lad, it makes perfect sense."
"What are we going to do?" asked the younger monk. "The spirits will be angry if Hoichi denies them music. They'll chase him and drag him to hell if he runs away. They'll never give him peace if he accepts their hospitality."
"That's right," said the abbot. "We must make them believe that Hoichi has disappeared. They must be convinced that he is beyond their reach."
"But how?"
Put to this question, all four men fell silent. The two young men rose, then bowed to the abbot, who placed his hand at the top of Hoichi's head and muttered the sutras quietly until his shivering ceased and he fell to a deep, exhausted sleep. As the sun rose on Shimonoseki, wooden gates creaked open to the call of merchants already feeling the new heat of the sun. Birdsong seemed to harmonize with the whisper of wind through leaves and the gentle swishing of water from a bucket being carried from the Amadaji well to the private quarters of the temple's abbot. Black and red ink was procured, and the finest paintbrushes of the artists who slept in simple temple beds between commissions. The two young monks who saved Hoichi from his fate the night before brought him to the abbot and were instructed first to light 100 sticks of Jinko incense, then to wash him with the water of the well, then to dry him carefully, then to kneel on either side of Hoichi and recite the sutras. As the two lads prayed furiously, the abbot prepared 2 pots of ink and instructed Hoichi to undress. He did as he was told and stood perfectly still as the two young monks each took a pot of ink and a fine paintbrush and covered Hoichi in the sutras they spoke in prayer. They covered his chest, arms and legs, his face and the top of his head. They covered his neck and his shoulders, his thighs and his knees, even the soles of his feet. He was gently fanned dry as the sun began to greet the horizon. In the misty twilight, the monks brought Hoichi to the veranda and set him down. They placed his biwa before him as the abbot recited a final prayer before explaining in careful detail the minutiae of the plot.
"Do not speak. Do not call out. No matter what happens, make no sound. For if the samurai hears you, he will attack you. He will be as blind as you are. But he is, as all ghosts are, persistent. Remain perfectly still, and let him stalk our temple looking for you. At dawn, we will retrieve you."
"What happens tomorrow? And the day after that? How long must I remain still each night? What happens when I leave the safety of the temple and return to my travels? What stories can I tell that will not call forth the ghosts of my subject? The old abbot placed a hand pensively on the top of his own bald head and let a long breath seep from his lips. He had no answers for this poor man. He knew, no, hoped, only, that tonight would pass without incident. He said one more prayer, then retreated to his bed for the evening, leaving Hoichi and his questions to the cool night air. Hoichi tried not to tense as he heard the shuffling clatter of the samurai's armor. He could feel the footsteps warp the wood beneath him with the weight of the warrior as he climbed into the veranda.
Hoichi! Hoichi! Hoichi?
The samurai looked around, stroking his chin and thinking.
There is Hoichi's biwa, but the hands that wield it are nowhere to be found.
There was more stomping, more wood creaking under the weight of armor, more calls for Hoichi's name into the darkness. Hoichi could feel a chill down his spine as the frigid presence of the samurai came close to him, but he suppressed his impulse to shudder, terrified that the ghost would spot him. What devilry has taken Hoichi from my lord but left his biwa? And his ears? Hoichi held his breath. Every muscle in his body was tense as he felt the rough, calloused fingers wrap around his earlobes and wrench. Hoichi could barely taste the blood in his mouth as he bit down on his lip to stop the screams of agony that welled inside him from spilling out. He barely let out a breath as he faded into a shocked unconsciousness. The samurai held the bloody, torn pair of ears in his hand, like silver tails won in a friendly bet, grimacing down at them, then shuffling them in his palm.
If I cannot bring the biwa player to my lord, I will bring these as proof of my fealty. Oh, poor Hoichi. He surely would have been given a place in my lord's court to play his song of Denonora forevermore at my lord's pleasure. A pity there is nothing left of him but these ears. Just enough of him to prove I fulfilled my task.
The dawn peaked from over the humble pagoda of Amadaji, and found a glimmering pool of blood drying in its new warmth. The abbot was the first to find Hoichi laid out on the veranda, whimpering and shaking as the pain set in, but daring not to howl out in agony, for the samurai may return. For many weeks, Hoichi slept in the abbot's bed, the softest in Amadaji, and for many weeks the abbot sat in contemplation and penance in the central temple. The elder of the two young monks came one afternoon to check in on the abbot and deliver twice good news.
Master, your penance is complete. Hoichi has awoken, and though his ears will never grow back, he will pull through. There is no infection, and his appetite is strong.
Ah, thank heavens for that.
In a way, continued the monk, it's a blessing that we forgot to paint the sutras on Hoichi's ears, is it not? The specter would have kept looking for Hoichi for eternity if he didn't have a trophy to bring back down to Jigoku for his lord. In that way, Hoichi has traded his ears for his life.
Perhaps, said the abbot, but that trade is far from equitable. What is a biwa player without his ears?
A biwa player, still. Hoichi the Earless and his strange tale spread far and wide from Nagasaki to Sapporo. The ghostly tale reached brothels, inns, clubs, and courts. Rich men from Tokyo and Osaka came to Amadaji with their itinerants paying vast sums to hear the song which brought the long dead forth. For many years, until his last days and well beyond that, Hoichi's legend grew, becoming a tale told by those like him on cold, misty nights, when the spirits are about, and the mood calls for a strange tale they might enjoy.
There is a rich history, not just of folklore itself, but those who preserve, interpret, and share it. Japan is the home of what many consider the first novel, and that literary tradition is steeped in folk culture and mythology. Figures like Murasaki Shikibu, Ueda Akinari, and Yei Theodora Ozaki established and maintained a great deal of Japan's folkloric identity through its darkest chapters. Less than a century after her ports were forced open, and Japan's industrialization led it to the world stage as a vast and rapacious empire, she surrendered to the same entity that initiated its modernization, the United States Navy. Crippled by two horrific nuclear attacks on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, Japan was a nation adrift and occupied, disconnected from its culture, but resolute to rebuild itself in the wake of the war. Japan's writers and intellectuals turned to their oldest traditions, kept alive by a quirk of history, Hearn and Yanagida's writing, which proliferated around the world and in turn came back to a Japanese generation hungry to reestablish the spiritual and narrative connections that the modern empire had severed in a misguided attempt to culturally modernize through adherence to Western ideas of civilization and industrialization. This new generation devoured the work of Hearn, Yanagida, Ozaki, and Akinari, using these parables of ghosts, spirits, and karmic justice to establish a vast cultural landscape which almost all people from around the world are enriched and fascinated by today. You can hear further discussion about Kwaidan, the foundational Lafcadio Hearn anthology which was adapted into a brilliant film by master director Masaki Kobayashi, on the First Watch podcast. Cole and Zach graciously invited me to join them for a wonderful discussion on the work of Kobayashi and other post-war film directors who reinterpreted and kept alive the folk stories preserved by Yanagida and Hearn as part of an incredible and vital cinematic tradition. Find them on Spotify. If you'd like to support the show, you can find us on patreon.com/breakfastwithgilgamesh. A huge thanks to Sam Beck for designing my logo, Thomas Holden for composing the music you heard throughout, and to all my collaborators, friends, and supporters. This is Breakfast with Gilgamesh.